Welcome on to end of the week edition of the pod. I want to do a little bit of self-plug for the pod with Ben Taylor yesterday, talking about some of the underrated and overrated players in history. I thought he was incredible. I hadn't really talked much to him before, but really enjoyed my conversation with him. I know some people might maybe skip that over because you haven't heard of him and you're more used to our usual thing, but I really recommend that interview a lot. He brings a unique perspective, and he's also really entertaining, well-spoken also. But today we have to get into our point guard rankings. Probably will prove the most controversial. There's probably the most depth at this position in terms of star players of any in the NBA. So, Danny, just first off, why don't you just say what our methodology is here in ranking these guys?
The primary focus here is if you could have this player for the rest of this season. And I tried to not think about as much of specific injuries unless it is an injury that will persist, you know, like throughout something like that. So like John Wall being hurt right now isn't as much of a thing as more as
I thought of it a little differently. If an NBA a full NBA season were starting right now,
that's a better way of phrasing it.
Who would you rather have? And yeah, so like the nagging injuries don't include as much. If it's something major or something we think we might have an effect in the guy's career going forward over the whatever the next full season he plays is, then I definitely will include that.
And that means that this is different fundamentally from like a prospects pod where it's where will this guy be, you know, who do you want for the next 3 to 5 years, who will be good is very, very different. So for example, rookie point guards generally do not fare well for me on this list because most of them do not provide much value. There is one exception to that, and I will talk about that guy. And doesn't really matter for guys, you know, on the back end of his career. The way that matters more is if you think that's dispositive in terms of whether this is a good or bad year. And one basic criteria for me, which is different at point guard than any other position in the league because of its responsibilities, is this idea of if you had this player theoretically with reasonable surrounding talent, so not necessarily any dominant players, but also none of those true just absolute dead zones, how good of an offense would you expect to have? Because if you don't have that shot creation ball handling from this spot, you are going to need it somewhere else, and that exists other places, but it's a lot harder to find. And so that was valuable to me.
And especially if not only are you not a great offensive player, but then you also can't hit shots off the ball as well. And I think especially for point guards, I think that the further you go in the height along the height spectrum, the more important defense becomes. So definitely, you know, if a guy has a neutral RPM and he's great on defense but not very good on offense, and another guy is great on offense not very good on defense in terms of RPM, I would certainly lean toward the guy who skews more towards offense at this particular position.
And that gets more relevant at certain points in the conversation. It is weird that there aren't as many real defensively dominant point guards around the league right now, partially because some of the better defensive players have just aged out of that. John Wall is a big example of this. I'll talk about that later. But you have those differentiation points, and in certain cases that comes up. Anything else you think we need to get through?
No, who's your number one?
Steph Curry. Not a lot of drama there. The idea of what can this player do for his offense is such a ludicrously strong thing for Steph. I think when I did my awards stuff, so that was March 1st, the Warriors had like a 120 offensive rating when he's on the floor, and you go, oh yeah, well, he played with Kevin Durant. But for those who watched the Warriors when Curry was out with that first, the more severe of the ankle sprains, they were a completely different team. They still had 3 all-stars, and their offense totally changed. Curry has that value. He did before Durant was there. He you know, if Durant left, he would have it afterwards. And that is fundamentally different for me. Like, he is in a tier by himself because he has proven that at a different degree. And, you know, I've been a big Chris Paul advocate for a long time. He will be very high on my list, but he is not at that level for me right now.
Yeah, the gravity that Curry has is just ridiculous. The effect that he has in transition in particular, he's so good at running the floor. He's so good at moving off the ball. He's really has the most gravity of any player in the NBA, and he never stops moving. I think defensively, one-on-one, he certainly has his limitations, but as a help defender, in terms of just being smart, executing the system defensively, I think he's one of the better guys just at those particular aspects of defense. Good hands as well. Does tend to foul a little bit, which is a problem, but especially when you consider number one, the metrics this year, he's number 2 in the entire league in offensive RPM, 7.08. And for reference, the only guy higher in offensive RPM is James Harden this year. He is 3rd in the NBA overall in RPM, and no other player outside of Harden has an offensive RPM within 1.7. Sona is. So that captures, I think, that especially as you get to the extremes, that RPM is more useful than when it's kind of in the middle. You know, if you're differentiating between, you know, guys who are number 30 and 60 in the league with RPM, you know, I don't think it means as much as it does at the top. And then his box score stats are awesome as well. He's outstanding in PR, all the blocks, box plus minus stuff. And if anything, you know, his great gravity, to me, those box score stats understate what he's doing. He has the highest true shooting percentage of his career. He's in the high 60s right now.
And that's what I wanted to mention. Yeah. He's shooting 60% almost on twos this year, which is a career high for him and a ridiculous number for a player.
58% on mid-range too.
Yeah, and highest free throw attempt rate of his career. And when you make free throws at the rate he does, that means a lot. That's how he's having the best true shooting percentage season of his career, despite not having that same just absolute molten, you know, he's 42% on threes this year as opposed to 44 and 45 during his MVP years.
Yeah, and he seems to be trending up still there as well. Has been a little bit more injury prone this year, but just no less durable overall the last few years than some of the guys around him. The one question I have about his game is, against switches, is he still going to be able to beat guys one-on-one to create at the end of games, which we saw from him in his two MVP years. Didn't see quite as much, but he may not even need to do that. And even if he can't do it at quite as high of a rate any longer, then we may still see that he is the best point guard here. So I had him in a tier by himself. Was that the case for you as well?
It was.
So I'll give the guys in my next tier, and I'll say them in order right now, but I will say that this was just absolutely splitting hairs. Very, very difficult to form any kind of a difference between these guys. But I went with, in order, there are four gentlemen in my next tier. Chris Paul, number two overall point guard, Damian Lillard, Russell Westbrook, and Kyrie Irving.
I have the same four guys in a different order. Chris Paul, Kyrie, Lillard, and then Westbrook. And I actually had Lillard over Kyrie until I got a good note that somebody had asked me who was better between those two guys. Kind of, not necessarily, I don't even know if they knew we were doing this podcast, but what I said was I think Lillard is the better player, but I'd rather have Kyrie in the playoffs. And they said, well, then you'd rather have Kyrie. And I said, that's a good point, because Kyrie's one-on-one scoring, Dame has been fabulous, but what he has proven in the playoffs against great defense, I mean, he has Klay Thompson on him a lot in those three NBA finals. Klay Thompson is one of the best one-on-one defenders on point guards in the entire league. That has intense value with LeBron or without LeBron. So that's why I ended up putting Kyrie over Lillard. But yeah, between these four guys, I have Chris Paul a slight bit ahead of these guys. He used to be a lot more, mostly because a lot of these guys rose and he's fallen a little bit, but it was brutal between all four.
Paul, I thought I had the best argument for ranking him ahead of the other guys, but as the oldest, there's more of a chance that he could fall off it. And my reasoning with Paul, he's not the one-on-one scorer that these guys have been, although he's added that more to his game with Houston, where teams are just switching him on pick and roll. I mean, he's unguardable in that Houston system with conventional pick and roll defense. So he's getting switched a lot. He's having to go to the ISO game more. Adding the deep three-point game this season as well has been huge for him. He's just as efficient as he's ever been. He is actually number three overall in the NBA in RPM. But the biggest differentiator to me, and we've seen this in Houston system, watching a lot of Houston lately, I've started to get more clarity on this, of how good their switching defense actually is. And we've seen they shut down the Bucks and the Thunder pretty well in these two back-to-back games that they both won pretty comfortably. And Paul is a huge part of that, because of all these guys, I mean, you would have to go down to maybe like an Eric Bledsoe to find someone, I think, who's as good of a switch defender as Paul is. And Bledsoe, I have him in the early teens, because Paul is just strong and he competes and he's not willing to let himself get posted up. And that's just so key. I mean, eventually sometimes I'll have to double if he's really got a tough mismatch and the guy gets deep, but he makes it difficult enough that like the guy has to take a couple of dribbles. He has to really back down and then the help can come there. And so his ability to play in a switching system and hold up in the post, in addition to being a solid one-on-one defender out in the perimeter still as well, that to me is just makes enough of a difference, especially if we're talking about really the best of the best in the playoff crucible. That's why I have him just a little bit above the rest of these guys. And then Westbrook clearly has been much less inefficient than the rest of the, or much less efficient than the rest of these guys this year. But I think also, despite some of his defensive issues, the fact that he also can switch and hold up one-on-one against most players, I think it is important in the playoffs. You know, I would still have him above Irving defensively. Even Lillard is a guy who's a little bit better than Irving defensively. And I think that we've seen now with switching becoming so much more important, in today's NBA that having one weak link defensively can end up really hurting you. That's just almost more of a prediction. But again, I like, if you wanted to put Kyrie Irving number two, if you wanted to put Lillard number two, if you wanted to put Westbrook number two, more just because of his history and the athleticism that he brings to the table, I wouldn't argue too vociferously with you.
That's also the reason why I originally had my next two guys, who I won't name yet because we'll go through this whole tier, in this tier. And then what I realized is the whole point of a tier was that you could argue the guys in any order. And when I got right to those two, I'm like, oh, like I couldn't put them over Chris Paul. So they're not in the same tier then. And I thought for a hot second about putting Chris Paul in a tier by himself. But no, I think the separation where I drew it was fine. And with Westbrook, something that really weighed against him a little bit, and it's not, I mean, he's still a wonderful player for me, is I think he has less offensive role versatility than a lot of these other players. So Chris Paul this year is playing on and off ball more than he has at a lot of moments in his career. He did have some with Blake Griffin, though a lot of Blake's time with the ball in his hands was when Chris Paul was not on the floor. Kyrie has that experience plenty with LeBron. With Westbrook, he makes every team Westbrook-y to a point, and that is a positive in most circumstances, but there are some where if you had another guy who's capable of the ball in his hands, he's not a great shooter. He's very confident in his shot. And also, I think his tendencies for just taking bad shots sometimes, like deep shots if they're open, that aren't really the right shot for their offense, that you can play him, you can kind of exploit him differently than some of these other guys. And you're right about the defensive part of it, but for me, that idea that, okay, in a playoff series, there are things you can do to use his strengths against him is not as true for the other players as it is for Westbrook.
All right, much more to get here. Also got some news coming at the end of today as well. But first, this from a new sponsor, Sonos. I've got Sonos up and running in my house. I'd always really wanted one. My buddy has a bunch of nodes in his house, and so I really wanted to get it because we listen to a lot of podcasts, we listen to a lot of music when you're doing the dishes, when you're, you know, in various rooms in your house, if you're taking a shower. And Bluetooth is just such a bad technology, and you have to like turn on the Bluetooth speaker, and then you wait like 30 minutes for it to recognize, or 30 seconds for it to recognize, and then sometimes it doesn't work, or it'll only do phone audio, but it won't do regular audio. It's really, Bluetooth is a pretty miserable technology. Sonos actually works through the Wi-Fi in your home. It's much more reliable. It comes on immediately. You can select different rooms via the Sonos app. You can play directly from the Spotify app as well. And generally, I could be pretty handy, but it's kind of when I'm setting stuff up, and Sonos is really easy to do. But they have this service called Up and Running that will have a trained expert deliver and set up your system absolutely free. So they came over, I watched what they were doing. It wasn't really that difficult, but if you're not really technically inclined, or you just don't really have the time, they're able to just come over and set it up. And they even optimize the Sonos speakers for the room. If you have a phone, it'll play these series of pulses, and you bring it around the room, and it'll listen for the pulses and optimize the sound for each room. It's really an awesome system. Now I've got their play bar set up under the TV. I bought some mounting hardware to put it right under my wall mounted TV. There's a sub in the living room as well, and it's revolutionized the sound when we're listening to games, when we're watching movies, whatever it is. And the way to get started with Sonos is sonos.com. You can get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product at sonos.com. You got to use my promo code. This is a little different than the normal one, capspace10. Easy to remember there though, because you're getting 10% off. That's why it's capspace10, capspace10 at sonos.com. enter that capspace10 code and let them know that you came from us. So my next tier, tier three, had three players. Guys, if you're trying to think about it just in the conception, you know, I think of that second tier as really guys that we are probably playing at a superstar level. Tier three is an all-star, solid player, maybe not the kind of guy you'd look at as potentially being the best on a championship team. And it's not surprising that these are some of the best guys on Eastern Conference teams that have generally been mid-tier, with the Raptors a little higher. So it's John Wall. I had him at six. Kyle Lowry at seven, and Kemba Walker at eight. But all those guys really, I think, have some severe flaws. I shouldn't say severe, but obvious flaws that keep them out of that top group.
Kemba this year has really come on. I actually had him the highest. My only difference is I actually have John Wall not last in this group. I actually moved him to the next group, and I'll explain why. But Kemba's really, I think he's come on this year, and Charlotte has been so bad when he's been off the floor that they're not competing for the playoffs. But his his overall play?
Actually, I checked that. And
recently?
That is normalized to a degree.
I'll check it again.
Walker is only, when I went on with Haverstraw and Jade and those guys today, it's still a significant difference, but they're only like negative 3.5 with him off and like plus 3.6 with him on.
Okay. Oh, with the getting deeper in the big man front court probably really helped them, even though that's not technically Kemba really be it, with getting Zeller and Kaminsky and those guys playing together. Because they did have a couple big runs like that one against the Pistons. But I think Kemba did get lost in the shuffle a little bit just because overall for the team this year, that's been a part of why they weren't as good. But offensively, he's still capable. 567 true shooting isn't great, but not bad. And his assist rate's fine. Like it's there. And then defensively, he's capable. Not a standout, but not a deficient player either. And the reason why I had John Wall in the tier below is if we were basing it on last year, John Wall would absolutely be above these guys. I think last year John Wall would have been at least on the fringe of the tier above. That's how good he was last year. But I worry with his history of issues, especially with his knees, that last year was more the aberration than this year, even though you could argue that, at full strength, that he was playing limited. So I'm just conservative with that because last year was by far his best. That maybe more what he was in 2015-16 is where the baseline expectation should be for Wall, though he can over or underperform that in a given season.
Yeah, in 15-16, the thought was, he's been injured this year, so that's the outlier. But now this is another year of these injuries, and the hope is maybe that this latest surgery will cause him to not suffer any problems anymore, but usually that's kind of not how it goes as you get into your late 20s. The fact is he's out right now, but if we're starting a season, you don't know how well he's going to recover, and he has not played at the same type of level this year. 51% true shooting, 30% usage. Now, people wonder like, wait a minute, like Russell Westbrook, he's right about the same type of level, but he has even higher usage. But Westbrook was at a much higher level and really just had a very weird first couple months of the season. And since then, he's been right around a similar level where he's been. And so with Wall, the recurring knee injuries, only played 37 games so far this season. And his defense, as you alluded to, his rebounding has really fallen off, perhaps in part due to the injury. So major concerns there with him. I mean, I had him still at the top of this tier because I think at his best, he's the best of these guys. And Lowry, he's just on the downside right now. I mean, he was a top 10 player in the NBA based on the on-off metrics the last couple of years, but he's fallen off of that level, now only eighth among point guards in RPM, and or I should say seventh because they list James Harden as a point guard, but also just has not been the same kind of force defensively.
I would say offensively too.
As well. Creating shots, he was really down to 22% usage. He's not just the main engine of an offense the way you could have said a year or two ago.
Early on, I would have expected, if he had said at this point, the Raptors are going to be a really strong offensive team, my assumption would have been, Kyle Lowry played at that level, and they didn't. No, they've been using DeRozan more as a creator. They've also had spectacular bench production on both ends of the floor. And so Lowry is he is a part of a strong machine, but he's not as important a part as before. And this is his
age. They're closing games with Van Vliet, who's taking on some more of the playmaking as well.
Sure. And this is his age 31 season. So the expectation would be that he's post prime. That doesn't, you can be pretty close to the level you were at before. It doesn't have to be a steep drop up, though it often can be. And his defense has also, to me, been worse. And so you have those things running together where it's like, he can step down and I think he can do it gracefully. But I would expect as of now that this is the highest he will be, the strongest position he will be on my list if we keep doing this going forward.
Yeah. And by the way, I misspoke. He's seventh in offensive RPM. He's actually fifth in overall because his defense still ends up looking pretty good. So you had then John Wall at the start of your next tier. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So my next group is, and this is where I draw the lines where, the ranking is still somewhat important, but it's getting a little bit more fluid here. We talked about how that was hard in tier two. John Wall, Drew Holiday, Goran Dragic, Mike Conley, assuming reasonable health for Mike Conley, there's still the risk of injury, but that he comes back, and Eric Bledsoe. And those guys all have very different arcs to their careers. I mean, Drew Holiday had some strong times in Philly that led to New Orleans trading for him, but then all the battles with his leg issues. Conley has been spectacular a lot of the time when he's been healthy, but dealing with the Achilles issues. Bledsoe, he's going through all that. So yeah, I guess there are injury issues for all of them, but when they rose, when they fell, and Holiday being as high as he was a little bit surprising to me, but he's had a really good year in a way that I think is repeatable for him moving forward.
Yeah, and he also has the size defensively. For for me, I think the one difference we had was I had Wall in the tier above this. I had number 9 was Mike Conley, 10 was Holiday, 11 was Eric Bledsoe, and then I cut it off. I know you had Dragic in this tier, but check out his stats this year. They're actually like not very good. And I think, you know, in his early 30s, he's on the downside. I think defensively, he's really gotten attacked at times this year, watching what Houston did to him, for example, late in that game when they won it in Miami. It was one of those. And I think I had Conley at number 9. If he weren't injured this year and he weren't getting older, I probably would have had him up in the same tier as Kemba Walker and Lowry. But with that continuing Achilles issue, getting older, he's not going to play at all this year. You have to build in probably some regression due to the age and injury. So that's why I moved him down a little bit. And then Holiday and Bledsoe, you know, neither of them are amazing scorers. I think I liked Holiday a little better than Bledsoe due to his superior shooting ability. Both of those guys really get into the ball defensively. They've for point guards, they're solid switch guys also. So I think that they're clearly above someone like Dragic, who doesn't have that two-way ability and has also been markedly less efficient than either of those two guys this year. And he's older than both of them, so he's more on the downside if we're talking about another year still going forward out of right now. That's why I had him slightly lower, though I had him near the top of that next year. And he's was not a legitimate all-star selection to me, unfortunately, although he's had other years where I think he's been a lot better and a lot closer to that.
The reason I had him in here is mostly because of his passing. I just think if you have the surrounding talent that balanced out in this case, that he can create good shots for other people. And you're right that the defense is a negative for him, but I just trust him more in that realm. And it is also, there's a parallel here with John Wall in that Dragic was better last year than he was this year, but this year is pretty in line with what he did 2 years ago. So it's not.
Yeah. I don't, why is Dragic considered some great passer?
I just think like he's pretty average.
Yeah.
Well, I don't love any of these guys really as pass. I mean, Wall when he's okay. On it, obviously. I've just never really with Bledsoe. He has some spectacular. I mean, that one he threw from the baseline that was about a week ago was one of the best passes I've seen all year. But I don't see Bledsoe creating those kind of quality looks for teammates as often as I see it with Dragic. And that could also totally be sample bias. It absolutely could be. I acknowledge that.
No, but Bledsoe is not as good of a pass Dragic. I would agree with that. I mean, Bledsoe, we've seen, just watching a lot of Bucks in the past couple of weeks, he's missed a lot of passes. I agree with you there, but I think he does enough more. And Dragic, you know, the argument for him used to be his efficiency, but only 53% true shooting this year is a big drop-off for him.
And the other arrow in your quiver there, if you wanted to, is that it is a big drop-off for him from last year, but it's not a big drop-off for him from 2 years ago. So you could say, well, that's just who he is now, and that he had a bounce because he hit a couple more threes, and that sort of thing can happen, and it certainly did. Last year, I think he hit... Last year was 40%.
He was 40% on threes last year, which you did not expect to continue. So I guess I stopped doing just like the very discrete rankings now at this point, as we've done with some of the other positions, but I did create another tier, and I guess I had one more tier, so
I can explain it. Okay. And I think it's a good clarifying mechanism for me. So I called these guys the in-betweeners. And so the logic of it was players who are not pretty clearly not as good as everybody else. And that's part of the reason why I included Dragic in that group, was because I felt more comfortable with him there than in this one. And then we're above another group, which are the guys that are starters that I'm not enthusiastic about. So that's Dennis Schroeder and Reggie Jackson, kind of guys more in that realm. And so I just created this group where I pretty clearly felt like they weren't in one and they weren't in the other. And so I called them the in-betweeners. And so for me, that group was Darren Collison, Jamal Murray, Jeff Teague, and Ricky Rubio. And then there's a sub-tier of it, which I called the Lost Seasons, where it's Donovan Mitchell in the Lost Seasons, where it's Mitchell, Beverly, Isaiah Thomas, and George Hill, where those guys...
I thought Mitchell is... we ranked him in shooting guards already, didn't we?
Oh yeah, that's right. I put him in here just for my own thought exercise, because we did that one in, like, November, so I'm like, okay, here's where he'd be. We don't have to talk about him much. That's where I'd have him. Call that a little bonus. But so that's really how I saw it. And so for me, Collison, Murray, Teague, and Rubio in particular, they have separated themselves out. I've been very impressed with Collison this year. I've been very critical of him as somebody very familiar with his career as a UCLA guy. We were in college together. I just never thought he could create very well for other people, and his defensive talent didn't really manifest in the NBA as everybody got so much bigger and stronger. But he has been essential for the Pacers offense, even though he's not Victor Oladipo.
Yeah, I thought about putting him in kind of my next year. My next year was just sort of like, all right, you know, solid starter type of players, where you're not like, oh man, we need an upgrade here. at this position if we really want to compete, but, you know, are not necessarily killing you either. And that's even reductive. I mean, because some of the guys I have in there are very, very different players. But I call us in a little bit below, you know, in the low teens, just because I think defensively still is not great. And while he's very efficient and deserves a ton of credit for the shooter that he's become, I think his usage is below 20%. And when your usage is below 20% as a point guard, it's hard to just put you into the same type of category. And then he's also coming off of this knee injury. He's 30 already. So looking at him going forward, that was kind of the tiebreaker for me. I actually had him higher up early on, but then I moved him down. And, you know, he's never been a darling of the on-off type of metrics to my recollection either. So that's having toiled with the Kings for a while. It's not like, you know, the Kings were doing awesome when he was on the floor, though they have many other issues. But so my next group was six here. So this would basically be 12 through 17. Dragic was near the top of that list for me. Jeff Teague, Spencer Dinwiddie, I think has really emerged this year. And yeah, this is his first year playing at this level, although he's pretty good at the end of last year too. But I'm not really sure like what else he needs to do at this point to get to be considered a solid starting point guard. All the on-off metrics, he's been very, very effective this year. He's ninth in offensive RPM so far. He shoots threes, deep threes. He's basically for a lot of the year been the only guy they have that can run pick and roll. He faces a lot of switches. He's actually able to create against that. He gets to the basket. He's got more burst. He's got good size, solid shooter. And you know, defensively, I haven't been wowed by him, but I haven't been like, oh, this guy's awful. And he's got good size. So I think he's right in the mixer. You did not have Dinwiddie quite this high, I take it?
I did not. And one of the big differences, this might just be because he's taking more shots even per possession than in the past, but his free throw attempt rate has really gone down. And he had a crazy year from three last year, shot 38%. This year he's at 33. And I think he's more of a 33-34 shooter. And so if he is that level, and you should say his free throw attempt, you could say his free throw attempt rate should be higher because there are some of these calls that he absolutely should get. That was a part of Chris Herring's piece. I do like Dinwiddie, but I'm generally, and people have criticized me slash us for this in the past, I'm conservative when a guy comes up as quickly as he has. Just, okay, I want to see a little bit more. And I'll give you the credit once I feel that it's locked in there, like with Jrue Holiday. I mean, he had to prove it for me for a little bit longer to get there. So I have him a little bit down from here, but if he can do it, I'd say it's more even the beginning of next year rather than the end of this year, because the Nets don't really have any stakes right now. So it might be unfair to him. I am open with that, but that's the way that I approach it, is I just need to see more than I think most people do to put somebody in an elevated plane.
Yeah, that's understandable. I think it's a lot of this is just based on watching him and the burst that he showed and how comfortable he's looked.
Oh, he's been far better this year, to be sure. And also with his size, Dinwiddie's defensive versatility is very intriguing.
So if you wanted to react to the rest of what I had there with Teague, Dragic, Isaiah Thomas is going to be very controversial here, very difficult to rank. And then Jamal Murray and Ricky Rubio are the others that I had in that tier, which is basically from about 12 through 17.
It's not too different from my own. Jamal Murray is benefiting for the first time in any of our rankings from us doing one later in the year, because when we've done the prospect rankings, he started both of his seasons slowly compared to the rest of it, and we would do the top 10 young players then. And so he's been good the rest of this year. I mean, not incredible, but good enough to certainly qualify in this group. Jeff Teague
frustrating. About Murray for a second here.
Sure.
Murray is 13th in offensive RPM. His defense is certainly a problem, especially when he's playing with some of the bigs that Denver is bringing out there, specifically Jokic. But I think he at least has shown the ability to impact his team positively on the offensive end, which we haven't seen from a lot of these young point guards yet. And I think he at least tries defensively. He at least tries to execute the system, even if one-on-one, he's really bad. So the biggest reason I had him higher in this group is I just think as an offensive player, and then also if you're just projecting going forward another year here as well as a younger guy, I think that he would be more likely to take some steps forward. We've been higher on him than a lot, but I mean, it's not, we're very high on Dennis Smith, and I have a feeling he's I can't even see him in the rankings right now from where we are at this point. But I think for Murray, just to be a guy who can shoot the ball off the dribble, I think that he could be a better passer than he's shown, because he hasn't had the ball in his hands as much. There's a lot of other guys who need to eat on the perimeter there, and then, you know, they run so much through Jokic, he's playing more off the ball, but he's shown the ability to do that. So I think if you were to put him into another situation, really have him running pick and roll all the time, he might be more effective potentially as a passer. But that, I'd certainly understand wanting to to rank him lower, especially because of his defense and just because young point guards generally aren't that good.
Did you have as much trouble with Patrick Beverley and Isaiah Thomas as I did?
Thomas in particular, because, I mean, if we did these rankings at this time last year, he would have had an argument for being right in that same tier with Lillard, Paul, Irving, and Westbrook. I mean, he had one of the great offensive seasons that we've seen last year. But obviously, that's not the case any longer. He's still coming back from this hip injury. Looks a little better with the Lakers, but the explosion still doesn't appear to be there. He gets into the lane, doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't have the explosion to finish the way he's used to. Turns it over a lot. He still gets to the foul line plenty, but he's going to become very reliant on his jump shooting. And then defensively, I've maintained that he's not as bad as everyone else thinks he is, because he'll at least like try to get over screens a little bit. But, you know, certainly a guy who can be taken advantage of in isolation and as a help defender is powerless due to his height. So those are all concerns. I put him in this tier just because I think he can make an improvement from where he's been so far to get to at least a level where he can start for a team and provide some decent offense and shooting. But, you know, that could well end up not being the case. It is really difficult to say. But I tried my best to not be skewed by what he was last year, because I have a fear that that player is gone.
He has shot better with the Lakers. That better shooting from three is 32%, which is still not nearly what it needs to be. And the burst, as you said, has been it's been concerning as well. So I think he will look healthier in 6 months than he does right now, and that will make a substantial difference for him.
If you're ranking him on what he did this year, he would be like, you know, 97th.
I think I said he was one of the most destructive. I think we both have said this, that he was one of the most destructive players in the league when he was playing for Cleveland. I mean, just because he was taking a lot of shots and he wasn't making them, and he wasn't creating the looks for himself or others. But I still see a lot of talent in him. He's still a very talented passer, especially. I think that's something he can use. But you need the burst and you need the threat of the jump shot to make that actually sing and actually work. And the uncertainty with him can reduce a little bit this season. But the fact that he's going into free agency this year is so complicated, because I wouldn't be looking at this thinking, oh, it is a down year. But I wouldn't be thinking of it going, it's a down year off of what last year was. Where are you calibrating off this? Are you calibrating off 15-16, 14-15? Or is this just a new equilibrium for him?
Yeah, and I fear it may be the latter. I mean, in a nod to what he was before to some degree, and just the fact that he can't continue to be this bad, you would hope I ranked him here. But it wouldn't shock me if we look back on this in a year and he's just like, you know, almost like out of the league type of level, just backup point guard, score off the bench, hope that he gets hot that day type of level.
One guy we both had in this level and we haven't really talked about enough is Ricky Rubio, a player who has been divisive his entire career, including his pre-NBA career. He was divisive, and I haven't seen as much just anecdotally defensively as early in his career when he was, I think he was underappreciated, especially those mid-years in Minnesota defensively, partially because they had some weaknesses on the front court, which sabotaged them. But his shooting has been better this year, especially recently. It's been a big part of Utah's run. And his ability to mesh with Mitchell, I think, does create a little bit more value, because originally, early in his career, you would say, well, that's never going to work, because while he's a spectacular passer, he can't really provide much value off ball. I think he's been better this year than I anticipated, and he's been solid defensively at bare minimum.
Yeah, so much depends on whether the jump shots falling, whether he's feeling comfortable getting in the room. I mean, I think he is a quality passer. His defense continues to be underrated. I would put him among starting point guards in the upper echelon defensively. And I think he's proven this year in Utah that he can be part of a winning situation, a solid point guard who's, it's just because he has such severe strengths and weaknesses, you know, it's just it's kind of hard to deal with. And I would certainly understand the argument for having him a little bit lower, but I think just the fact that he doesn't make too many mistakes other than turnovers on occasion, that he always plays hard. You know, I mean, he's not the kind of player who's on a bad team, you know, it seems like. And while from an RPM standpoint, he hasn't been as high as he has been when he was in Minnesota, you know, he makes enough winning plays that I think he deserves to be, you know, kind of in the lower end of this tier. But especially if you're talking about as a playoff player, if you're talking about a guy whose weaknesses could be exploited, I would certainly understand having him lower as well. And it was, I found it was interesting, really, the most difficult rankings for me were, you know, guys in this kind of 15 to 30 range, because there's a lot of reasons to like and dislike guys in this range, and zeroing in on what's really important, it can be difficult.
The two guys that I think had the most baggage for me are Schroeder and Reggie Jackson, because they have been starters. I mean, now for a little while now, since Teague left when he was traded, incidentally, within that George Hill trade, and somebody else who was hard to rank in all of this, and Reggie Jackson, both of them have been underwhelming, but still competent, I think is probably the best way that I would put it. And I have trouble squaring that with players who haven't had that opportunity yet. Dinwiddie has a little bit this year. Malcolm Brogdon never really did. He was somebody that I have around this level too. Alfred Payton's hard to quantify. Like, you have all these. So it's like, okay, is there a chance that Fred VanVleet is a better player than Reggie Jackson? Yes, absolutely. But until he's gotten more of a chance, I feel uncomfortable putting him there, which is probably just unfair to Fred VanVleet.
Yeah, I had Fred as kind of this next tier, which I thought of as just like, you know, I won't kill you as a starter. But even that, I mean, point guards could be so divisive, right? Like, if you just look at guys like Schroeder and Alfred Payton, guys who have been on bad teams, have put up some numbers, have had the ball in their hands enough, they seem like experienced point guards, but yet they have always just like, their teams have sucked when they've been out there. And how much blame do they deserve that? What would it look like if they went to another team? I just know that I've seen Spencer Dinwiddie for half a season play at a level that I think is beyond, you know, and Schroeder can put up some numbers, but he's really, you know, he's not a great passer. Defensively, he's awful. Ben Falk has written about that, just how bad he is as far as like a closeout guy, for example. And a
great example of the difference between defensive capability and being a good defender.
Oh, yeah.
Because when he came into the league, I mean, he moves well for his size. As I recall, he has a pretty good wingspan, and he played with intensity then, you know, when he was a like Hoop Summit age, and it just never materialized as a defensive player. And it wasn't, you know, like John Wall, where it, you know, got worse as he aged or something like that. Dennis Schroeder's 24. Like, he could very well be a much better defender than he has been so far, which is immensely frustrating.
Yeah, and then Jackson, he's hurt again. You know, I thought he was kind of a guy who would have ranked in the high 20 or the low 20s, you know, 21, 22, 23-ish range before he got hurt again this year, but he was hurt last year now, and so this looks like a pretty severe ankle injury. So how does that factor in? It doesn't look like he may not even play again this year. He was only playing 27 minutes a game as well before that. You know, he's a guy who has some weaknesses, and it's just the difference between, all right, Reggie Jackson, Dennis Schroeder, Tony Parker to some degree at this point. Do you want to value kind of shitty creation, or do you want to value just being more steady, like a Patrick Beverley, although obviously he has the injury concerns, VanVleet, Malcolm Brogdon, George Hill, although George Hill, if we'd done this last year, would have been, you know, 10 slots higher. He probably would have been, you know, just below like Eric Bledsoe the way he played last year. But, you know, with his injury concerns, it just hasn't been playing as well this year, really weighed down in the on-off metric. Patty Mills is a guy who's a real good shooter and will compete defensively, but is kind of undersized and doesn't really create for others. Corey Joseph.
I have one in this tier that you haven't mentioned. Ooh. Lonzo Ball. This is where I have him right now.
I had him slightly below in this next tier, just because of the weakness offensively still. I'm not quite there with the shooting. I know he's up to the low 30s now, and teams are at least guarding him, which is big, but he's just such a weird player. I know he's been better than expected defensively. I don't know if he's a great one-on-one guy yet, but he's been useful in their switching system, better than expected. Certainly deserves credit compared to his rookie point guard brethren for how much he's actually impacted winning this year. So I had him just below in this tier, just as a rookie point guard, and with those major weaknesses that you see still, I'm just don't have quite as good of a handle on him, but I would understand ranking him up in this level. And then also the health as well has been hasn't been amazing so far at this point in his career, but I had him at the top of the next group of guys.
Were you as surprised as I was that Alfred Payton is a 13th among point guards, and remember that includes James Harden and Ben Simmons on ESPN, so they don't count in PER? I did not see that coming.
Yeah, he's actually been,
I also don't necessarily believe it.
Yeah, I mean, he's been league average efficient, and he's always been a guy who gets a fair number of assists. He gets a fair number of rebounds, but I mean, he sure as hell hasn't been helping Phoenix since he got there. In Orlando, they got killed whenever he played, and he's another guy, just his shooting limitations, the fit is hard. He's another one of those guys who's like, all right, do you want shitty creation, or do you want just kind of a steady guy, but who's probably going to have to play next to another ball dominant guy? And so I think if you're really trying to build a good team, a Schroeder or a Payton, you know, those guys aren't good enough to really be the lead dog on a good offense. And so you're going to have someone else who is the lead dog. And then those guys don't really fit with the lead dog once they're playing with them. And so if you want to actually have a good team, like, yeah, you know, Dennis Schroeder, he probably got the Hawks from, you know, 19 wins to 25 wins this year versus if they just had nobody else. But, you know, how much do I really value that as opposed to guys who can really contribute on playoff level of teams as starter?
It should be noted, though, that I firmly believe if those guys went into backup roles that they would just kill against inferior talent there. And if they could control it a little bit more, generally weaker rim protection in those circumstances as well, I think they could do well. So that's why in those circumstances, I was more okay having them kind of, I put it above the next group for me is called fringier, where it's guys that you can make an argument are a starter, but it's just less likely or it's unproven. And that's where I have Van Vliet right now. Van Vliet, based on how he has played this year, would be higher than that, to be absolutely sure. But just like with Dinwiddie, I'm judicious about that. I just want to give him a little bit more time. Yeah. Is that kind of about where your line is drawn, or is there somebody else that we haven't talked about yet?
I had Teodosic was in this category for me. I mean, to give this next year. So I had Beverly, Darren Collison, Reggie Jackson, Van Vliet, Schroeder, Malcolm Brogdon, George Hill, Tony Parker, Patty Mills, Teodosic.
I didn't have Parker or Mills in mind.
Yeah. I mean, Mills is, he's just a different kind of player. I mean, he's probably, you know, among the best shooters of any of these players, right? So if you have him in a different role, and I'm sure part of why he's had a down year this year has been, you know, they just haven't had enough other guys to create those shots for him. But, you know, as a guy who moves off the ball and can hit shots, he's among the best of this whole group. So, you know, it just depends really on what the fit is. But if it's a guy who really, you know, he at least is not going to take anything off the table for others, and I think he competes defensively. So I think I have those guys a little bit more respected than, and, you know, Tony Parker, I mean, is he really, like, he doesn't play as many minutes anymore, but, you know, I probably might still rather have him running my offense than Dennis Schroeder.
I'd still have Schroeder there, but it is close. So that runs into my next tier. So you'll hear a couple names that were in your last one. Van Vliet, Elfrid Payton, Jeremy Lin, Chris Dunn, Terry Rozier, Satoransky, who I've really enjoyed, and I think I've liked the way that he's fit in there.
Yeah.
Seth Curry, lost season for him, but I still believe in his potential. Teodosic, Tyus Jones, Ish Smith, TJ McConnell, DeLon Wright, DeJounte Murray, and Corey Joseph.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to like Murray. I think he's been a force defensively, but, you know, he's got 48% true shooting. So that's not great. Have you said the name Tyus Jones yet?
Yes, Tyus Jones is in that group for me.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of guys who you just wonder, like a Tyus Jones, you know, he doesn't fit the profile of what you normally expect in a point guard. He more fits the profile of a backup point guard. Fred VanVleet, same way, even though he's played at a really nice level this year, he's a little undersized, even though he competes really hard defensively. You know, he's not really going to get to the rim and score that well, but he can hit some shots. It's just not what you think of as a conventional starter, whereas guys like Schroeder and Jackson are more what you think of as a conventional starter. They're just not as good at it as a lot of guys. And so would you rather have an awesome backup or a crappy starter? You know, it's really tough to say. DeLon Wright is kind of, he's a little bit above that tier for me, but, like, you know, he's a lot of guys who you really wonder what it would look like if they got a starting role. But it's all a question of whether you're valuing creation or you're valuing just being steady in more areas at this point.
And the surrounding talent is, of course, important there. Also, broadly speaking, this is less pronounced than it is for the centers, just because backup point guard is a more important position. You can't slide guys there as much. But I would not pay many of these guys unless you believe that they can become better. So the young guys in this group, like I have DeJounte Murray here. Sure, DeJounte Murray, Tyus Jones, they can get better. But like Teodosic, you pay them backup money. You don't pay them anything above that because there are so many guys here. And unlike certain other positions, you can find them either as sometimes as free agents or through the G League, things like that, as opposed to wings where you kind of have to roll the dice. Sometimes you need to draft them a little bit higher just because you can't get them any other way.
Yeah, and so I think we can talk now about some of the players who might be a little bit more controversial. You have not said the name Rajon Rondo yet, correct?
I have not.
And
is that I probably
do?
Will not.
Does that have anything to do with him being 76th in RPM among point guards this year?
Not particularly. I think it has more to do with his limitations, especially defensively, which is he's just a sieve on that end of the floor 90% of the time. And he doesn't do enough positive to make up for that negative. And he's a wonderful passer, one of the best entry passers in the entire league. And in certain circumstances, I think he can be a productive player. I have him in that kind of extra group where it's like, I call it solid backups. I have him in that group because I think he could really, in the right circumstance, help, especially if he had a young big guy who wasn't necessarily great at establishing position, like a Jahlil Okafor, let's say, yeah. Beyond the fact that their defense would be the worst thing in the world. He could get the ball to that guy and they could get in circumstances to succeed and develop. But outside of that, if it's a high leverage situation, much less having him as a starter, it's not going to work.
I had Rondo below even most of the guys that I thought of as solid backups, you know, like an Ish Smith, TJ McConnell, Shabazz Napier, just because, you know, he doesn't play hard really most of the time. He requires the ball. He's actually been more efficient this year than normal, but still, you know, not a guy who gets guarded a lot, not a high volume guy from three, and is someone who, if you sign him, it's like you feel obligated to play the guy. And, you know, I would rather not have to deal with that. And I think just, you know, he's 76 in RPM this year among point guards, 42nd last year, actually was 22nd that Sacramento year. And then the year before that he finished in Dallas, he was 46th out of 57 who were ranked. So it's really, it's not very good. And you just, there's no evidence that overall, you know, he had two good playoff games with Chicago last year, but there's no evidence that overall he is able to play at the type of level that's going to help a team. And he just takes so much off the table. I'd rather just have a guy who's just kind of like, all right, take care of the ball, hit some open shots, don't screw up, than a Rondo. But speaking of which, we should also hit on some of these other rookies. I mean, Dennis Smith Jr., De'Aaron Fox, both of them way down the list in RPM, both guys whose potential we like. I like Smith more than Fox, but both Smith has one of the highest usage rates among point guards. He's in the high 20s there, and he's shooting, you know, like 47% true shooting. And so you're just, and then his defense is sucked. So when you're taking that many shots at that low of an efficiency, and he takes a lot of bad jumpers, and, you know, he can distribute on the times when he plays well, he can look really good, but just on a night-to-night basis, it's going to get much better for him. But I mean, he's been actively hurting his team all season.
Both of those guys to me have been negatives this year, but that's what you expect from a player as young as they are, thrust into the responsibilities they have on a team that isn't very good. So I am not concerned by them being where they are in all of this, but it is fair to acknowledge it. And another guy who is kind of in this group, though he's a little bit better than that, and I'm sure some people will be pissed off that we haven't mentioned him, is D'Angelo Russell. D'Angelo Russell is a talented player who can be a good passer, but the shooting really hasn't come around for me. His defense is still abysmal, and he isn't a superlative passer. Incidentally, Lonzo Ball, who effectively replaced him.
He can throw superlative passes, but he's not a superlative passer. It just doesn't happen often enough, perhaps because just he doesn't have enough juice himself to really draw the defense and create the opening.
Now, if Russell, there's a parallel argument here to what I said about Dennis Schroeder before, that if he was put in a full backup role and said, hey, play as hard as you can for 20 minutes a game and play against backups, I think he would do well. And that might be where he ends up if he doesn't improve a lot.
Yeah, I don't know.
His age 20.
Even when Schroeder was a backup, though, in Atlanta, I mean, granted, he's better now than he was then in theory, but, you know, the numbers were really bad for him in terms of the on-off metrics when he was a backup, too.
Yeah, he was behind Jeff Teague then, and those teams had some really strong starters. I mean, we had Millsap and Horford together and Korver for a lot of that time. I'm not as concerned about that element. And D'Angelo Russell, this is his age 21 season, so he can certainly get a whole lot better, and he's been dealing with health stuff so much. But I would say right now, he's on the fringe of being a positive player. And if that's where you are, then you're not in those first batch of tiers for me. You could get there. He could absolutely earn that spot. But I have him as the third best, most valuable point guard on his own team if we're treating Jeremy Lin as being healthy at some point.
Yeah. And Russell, I kind of had, you know, in that same tier as Lonzo, which is ironic because they both have totally different games. And you can certainly argue that Lonzo has a greater impact on winning this year. I mean, I think Russell, as he continues to get healthy, can play a little better. That's part of still of just another year of growth for a young player going forward. But yeah, I mean, you could make the argument that he should be way down there in like the Dennis Smith, De'Aaron Fox type category.
That's where he is for me.
Yeah.
He's slightly above those guys, but not, yeah. But in the same group. And somebody else we haven't mentioned, just while we're getting Lakers fans and talking about their former players, Jordan Clarkson, I have him in this solid backup group as well. Yeah. I just don't believe in his offensive creation or his defense at a high level. I think in this, you'd be very happy if you had him as a, you know, 20 minute a game backup. Sure, by all means. But when you start pushing him up beyond here, I think his deficiencies come into play. Yeah. And
especially
that great game he played.
He's taking opportunities out of the hands of more efficient players if you really start playing him more,
if he's
on a good team.
And sure, he'll look good next to LeBron James because that's putting him in a situation where he's more likely to succeed than what you typically have a backup point guard doing, which is running the show.
Yeah, and Clarkson, I mean, you could also make an argument that he should have been in the shooting guard pod as well. I was surprised, actually, we didn't put him, but yeah.
We also might have, and I just didn't see him on there when I did the control F, but I did that, so.
Well, yeah, and then Frank Ntilikina maybe should be discussed too. 432 true shooting percentage and 6.8 PR. I've liked his defense. I've liked his passing to some degree this year, but just, I mean, it's hard to argue that he's been that effective because he cannot even come close to scoring efficiency. I mean, if you want to talk about where Fox and Smith are, I mean, Ntilikina is a whole order of magnitude below those guys, although he's probably been the best of these rookie point guards, I'd say, defensively, he and Lonzo.
There are a bunch of different guys in that solid backup group, but I don't really feel the need to run through the whole group, do you? I feel like it's more broad takeaways and stuff like that.
No, I think we should transition to a read before we do news here. When I was younger, I had a predilection for some old sports cars. I had a 1988 Mazda RX-7. I had a 1991 Nissan 300 ZX Turbo. And I would have loved back then, because, you know, old sports cars need to get repaired a lot, to know about yourmechanic.com. Probably would have needed a time machine as well, because it didn't exist back in the late 1990s. But if I had a car that, especially when it was older, that needed some work on regularly, yourmechanic.com would be the way to go. They come right to your home or office. I mean, that's one of the worst things about the repair shop, right? Is you go there and then you gotta like we're back, or you gotta have someone pick you up. And really, by the time you go there and talk to them and come back, that's probably like an hour in the morning. And then you gotta go an hour out of your way to go back, wait in line while everyone else is picking your car up at the end of work. Your mechanic takes that waiting out of the picture, because they come to your driveway, to your office, if you have a place to do it there, and they give you a quote up front that is the actual price you're going to pay. They'll even show you what it could cost to get the same repair elsewhere. And since they might be coming to your house, they give full background checks to all of their mechanics who have, on average, 10 years of experience. So if your car won't start, if it's something that's that urgent, or you have a check engine light bugging you, you need a brake job, you can call today to schedule an appointment, or visit yourmechanic.com/capspace and have a mechanic come to your home or office. You need to get $20 off your first service, which actually could be pretty significant if you're getting like an oil change or something. Two ways to get started with them. yourmechanic.com/capspace is the URL to let them know that you came from us, or if you prefer to call 800-701-6230, that's 800-701-6230, or yourmechanic.com/capspace, let them know that you came from us. So nice long one here. Got to get to some news as well after those point guard rankings. Where would you like to start, Mr. LaRue?
Even though I have my policy, I think we have to start with Kawhi, because he actually talked to the media, so we got more specifics on his situation. He said two things of importance. One is, he said he intends to play this season. The quote is, soon. I don't have a set date yet. I just have to keep doing what I'm doing. The progression I am making is great. I just have to keep doing what I'm doing. So that is significant, because the Spurs are going to need him back. But the other part was that in that same conversation with the media, he expressed a desire to finish his career as a Spur, which is the first clear indication that I can recall seeing that he is, you know, intends to sign with them, whether that's in the form of an extension, which he's already eligible for the designated veteran, or through something even as an unrestricted free agent.
Yeah, and to be clear, when you say he's already eligible, he's met the criteria to be eligible once July 1st rolls around, right?
Once the year turns over,
So they would, just to be clear, it's not like they could give him that extension at this very moment. Not much else to say here. I hope we see him back. The Spurs desperately need him. I mean, it's really going to affect the playoff race. I mean, they're in trouble right now with the way they've been playing. Pau Gasol is out with a sprained AC joint, could miss significant time. And while he certainly has some limitations, I think he's been effective this year as a defender. And it's really more about, too, well, if he's not going to play, then it's King Joffrey time. And it's just really difficult to be effective with your deep bench guys out there. Even if you are the Spurs, you're going to see somewhat of a drop off there. And on Kawhi, you know, this isn't definitive. People were quoting Kevin Durant saying he wanted to finish his career in OKC, but it at least is something to counteract the noise of my text message alerts going off. to counteract the noise that's been out there that he does want out. I mean, if he does want out, there's no reason to make it clear that he does. You might as well deny it. So it doesn't mean a ton, but at least it's something to have him speak to the media. In Minnesota, former MVP Derrick Rose has signed it with the Wolves. He said that the delay was that he was waiting for his kid to be born. This is a little odd, because Glenn Taylor had gone on the radio and said that, no, actually, we weren't going to be signing him. There are tons of conflicting reports. I don't know whether Taylor didn't want him, or whether Taylor just meant, oh, we're not going to sign him right now, we will later, or whatever. Glenn Taylor really just runs his mouth on local media way too much. I don't know why he does it, but that's just weird that the owner would say that, and then you end up signing the guy. But actually, I think I prefer, if in fact Taylor didn't want him, I prefer Glenn Taylor's basketball expertise to Tibbs in this case.
In the initial press conference, Tibbs said that he is open to playing multiple point guards together with their team.
Oh, he is? That's
a change. The fundamental problem with that is Derrick Rose isn't better than their options at the two. So it's not like you are getting what the Mavericks are getting, let's say, where you're playing two point guards because you have more good point guards than you have other players, especially with DFS being out.
And Derrick is one of the worst point guards that you could play in a two guard alignment because he can't shoot at all, or pass for that matter,
or play a lot of consistent defense. So it's a real problem. And Tyus Jones already was, I was worried that he wasn't necessarily getting enough minutes. You know, Teague has been solid overall this year, but you have those two guys, you have the balance that worked. I think Jones's defense fit well, especially when they had Jimmy out there, and just adding somebody who's worse than them, who has equity with the coach, which in some ways is more dangerous than has equity with the organization, depending on the circumstance.
Like, that's not how this works.
Right. So that probably makes them worse. And doing that when every game matters, this West is absolutely stacked, and they're playing without Jimmy Butler for the time being, who has been their best player this year. I had him, I think it was fourth in MVP or whatever it was. The margins are real tight, and this doesn't help. And so it is definitely concerning for me that they're going in this direction, especially because they have so many games against good teams. And we will see on, I can't remember if it's Thursday or Friday night, how quickly they're going to get into it, but it could take a week or two until we really see what the intended spot for Rose in the rotation
is. With every game critical here, can they really afford, even if you want to say, okay, once he gets up to speed, it'll be good. I mean, I think no matter who you're integrating, that generally that player is going to take some time to get up to speed. And at this late juncture of the season, don't really want to do that. And especially if he was so valuable, the fact that they just like, oh, you know, Rose's commitment to basketball has been questioned. And yeah, no, he wanted to wait for his son to be born. But still, you know, that's a month that he could have been basically getting integrated with this team. And the trade deadline was February 8th. So it's been a month now. And this just has disaster written all over it. Also, significant injury news here. Anthony Davis suffering an ankle sprain after he had this ugly rib contusion where he was really like doubled over in pain in that Clippers game that he was so awesome in. Then they play a back-to-back the next night, sprains his ankle in the third quarter. They win, but he doesn't return. And apparently the ankle swelled up significantly per Jennifer Hale Twitter account with the Pelicans. And he's going to have an MRI today, but it sounds like the type of thing where, you know, he's going to miss significant time. I mean, it's difficult to imagine. It's not going to be at least a week and potentially longer than that. I mean, we've had a lot of injury scares with Davis, but that's really too bad for a Pels team that had just been on fire lately. Maybe they've banked enough now. I think they're either third or fourth in the West. Maybe they've banked enough now to where missing him for a little while isn't going to kill them, but they actually, you know, we're playing Nikola Mirotic at center. I mean, they're going to really struggle, you would think, without AD.
This is also a very dangerous stretch for them because right now they have home games against capable teams, Washington, Utah, and we'll see with Charlotte coming up. But then right after that, at San Antonio, hosting Houston, hosting Boston. So those are games where they're going to need Anthony Davis and need Anthony Davis playing well to have a good shot. They can win some of them, of course, and Drew Holiday's having a nice season, all of that. But Davis is so essential for what they're doing. So I just talked about how the margins are tight with Minnesota. This is a whole different ballgame because Davis is a far better player than Derrick Rose and far more important to his team's success than Derrick Rose.
Turning to the Clippers, I actually reported something yesterday that per a source, the reason the Clippers aren't signing Tyrone Wallace right now, who's out of eligibility, he's used up the 45 days on his two-way, is because there's a dispute over what NBA contract he's going to sign. They do have the right to unilaterally convert him to an NBA minimum contract that lasts as long as his two-way contract lasts, which was till the end of this season. But they don't want to do that because then he would become a free agent. What they want is for him to sign a longer-term, more team-friendly deal, something along the lines, perhaps, I don't know the exact details, what the offers have been, but you would imagine something along the lines of the old Hinkie special with the 4 years team option at the end of it, some guarantees early, but some significant non-guarantees at the end. And so he's not willing to sign that. He wants to try to put the pressure on the team, especially if they're losing and they played a game without him that they lost against the Pels. Maybe he could have actually helped win that game for them if he plays. You know, he's been playing well. They lost that game by 2 points. points. So we'll see whether the pressure mounts on the Clippers to sign a contract that Wallace is more willing to sign, or just to automatically convert him. And then he's still just going to reach restricted free agency. They'll have the right to match this offseason. So this is the first one of these where a two-way guy has played well enough to clearly be an NBA player. And now we're seeing this standoff. And it's worth noting that other NBA players who were converted, nobody, I think, was unilaterally converted. They actually agreed on an NBA contract with guys like Mike James, who ended up subsequently being waived, Tyler Cavanaugh. It's a little different now because whatever he signs is going to be guaranteed for the rest of the season, where someone like Mike James, he actually got waived before then, before he ended up guaranteeing. He converted to a non-guaranteed deal. But this is just going to be really interesting, and it's going to set a lot of precedents here for what happens in this situation where they want to convert a two-way guy. But it does seem like a kind of unintended consequence here for the two-way guy, to where, you know, I'm sure the thought was, oh, they'll just convert the guy when they want him. But to have this stalemate, to me, after a guy has played really well, it's kind of too bad.
It's also even stranger because the Clippers have the playoff incentive and they're really, really close to the luxury tax. Yeah.
It's not about the tax anymore. They have enough room under the tax this year. I mean, and I think, I don't know how much of their mid-level exception they have left. They might actually be able to offer him slightly more than the minimum for the rest of the season, but not much. So it's almost certainly going to be a rest of season contract, but they do have room to give him a rest of season contract without going into the tax now. And instead they signed Sean Kilpatrick to a 10-day. The other thing that's totally interesting about this, which again, this is more about incentives. I don't know whether this will actually happen, is the way it works is you only get 45 days to be up in the NBA during the G League season. But it's your team G League season, right? So the Agua Caliente Clippers, I think are looking like they're going to be outside of playoff position right now. But if they made the playoffs, which start, I think, March 27th in the G League, once you're outside of your team's G League season, those two-way guys can come back up and play. He would be ineligible for the playoffs, but he could actually play for the big team for the rest of the regular season, and then perhaps sign a deal on the last day of the regular season. Even up until then, he could sign and be eligible for the playoffs. We can call that the Dante Jones. But there's an incentive almost to make the G League season be over faster so you can get this guy back with the team, because then his 45 days don't apply anymore. It's kind of ridiculous there as well.
It is, and that's always the challenge with a new idea, especially one as big as the two-way, is just the ways that it's going to be implemented. I mean, you saw that even though that was clear with some of the extension stuff, and the prior CBA was like, oh, we're trying to prevent this, and then it has all these other effects, and sometimes you're going to plan for it, sometimes you're not. But there are actually a couple other pieces of Clippers news. One of them, I think you know better than I do, which is the issue of the city of Inglewood being sued by Forum, which is owned by James Dolan, which is even more complicated because James Dolan owns the
MSG
Knicks.
Owns the Forum, and the Forum spent about $100 million, as I recall, to renovate and become this concert venue. And then they had this lease agreement with the city of Inglewood. This is the allegations in their complaint. These have not been proven true, but Ramona Shelburne had this story. They had this lease agreement with the city of Inglewood for a parking lot that's right next to there that they were leasing, and the city of Inglewood said, and also they claim that there's something in the contract where, you know, they can't build another arena. But supposedly the city of Inglewood demanded whoever it was who was involved was like, oh, hey, here, use my personal cell phone so it's not like subject to government records. And then he said, well, you know, we might have another tenant coming in or something, so don't exercise your right to buy this land that you're leasing right now. And so they didn't. And then it turns out that that's the land that the Clippers were hoping to build this new arena on, that's now going through the environmental review. The request to fast track that was denied. I won't bore you guys with how impossibly difficult and stupid it is to try and build something in California. But anyway, so this could potentially imperil that new Clippers arena anymore. And their lease at Staples Center expires in 2024. Maybe you could say if the arena gets done faster, they could negotiate an exit there. But Steve Ballmer's dream of getting his own arena seems to be running into a few snags. And then another snag, this is the Danilo Gallinari memorial injury slot of the podcast. He actually has a non-displaced fracture in his hand rather than a bruised hand, and it'll be at least probably another 10 days or so until they're thinking about him being reevaluated and returning. And finally, you saw that other Clippers thing too?
Well, yeah, I already knew about it. Yeah, so the Clippers also are, I think they became the 20th team to agree to a jersey sponsorship deal with the app Bumble. And the number I've heard is 20 million. I do not know how many years that 20 million is for.
My guess would be it's for, so, it's, I mean, for 3 years, because I think that the initial understanding was that this is a trial program for 3 years. So that is, that would be my guess. And that would probably be in line with what you would expect them to get, you know, since the top teams have kind of been maybe in like, you know, the $15 million range per season, and then, you know, down to maybe like $4 million for the worst teams. The Clippers actually just aren't that popular. So that's probably about what you would expect. And also maybe the fact that they've waited this long is they were hoping to get more and they haven't. And they're like, well, we better just do this anyway.
The Mavericks also announced a deal with 5 Miles, which is an app as well. And that is a 3-year contract, but I don't think we know the dollar amount. That I think first person I saw with that, well, the Mavericks announced it themselves. I saw Tim McMahon's tweet it, but it was from the Mavs themselves.
Yeah, and it looks like then we might see a little bit of a cap increase now that these deals are done. Albert Nahmad, who follows these things more closely than anyone I know in the public sphere, posited that his belief that the reason the cap projection went down from 102 to 101 for next season was fewer than expected jersey ads coming through. So maybe now that some more of them are going to happen, I think there's still 9 out there that remain, that maybe that could cause the cap to go up a little bit. He said he doesn't expect it to go down at all. And then the Bulls, the team that does not have a jersey sponsor yet, we've made fun of them for their resting of healthy starters. They have, in fact, finally run afoul of the NBA's resting rules. Cordial discussions, supposedly, with the league. And so when they're on the road, you're not supposed to rest guys, and then you're only allowed to rest 1 healthy starter at home. So they rested Robin Lopez and played Justin Holiday, and Justin Holiday actually played pretty well. And that was maybe part of why they won last night against Memphis. So this is all just totally ridiculous. The league is clearly more concerned with people writing about and the perception of tanking than actually curbing it. And I understand that, because I think we've said this before. I think tanking is a necessary evil. I think that the need to make bad teams have hope, or even if you have shitty draft picks, at least having draft picks on the roster who have the hope of being good for 2 or 3 years until they inevitably wash out, Sacramento, is enough to keep the fans going during that period. So I still think that, you know, something along the lines of the lottery system, the draft, that has some relationship to how bad your team is necessary. And, you know, tanking is something that you're never going to entirely curb, but it's better than just having teams that are just stuck in purgatory for years and years and years.
They could have a bigger conversation if they wanted to, but it appears that they do not. You know, they muted the incentives a little bit, but they didn't functionally change them, because it's more important to have the prospect of bad teams getting better than it is to have the fairness and avoid the tanking in their eyes. And broadly speaking, I agree with that. My proposals are out there. I have the Sporting News one about abolishing the draft. The one element that the NBA needs to do a much better job of with this is in terms of scheduling. The goal that I would have if they could input this is like a constraint, and there are a whole bunch of other factors, including arena availability, travel schedules, all that kind of stuff, is the goal would be for a team to not play any single opponent for me more than once after the All-Star break. March 1st, if you had to do it that way, and if you have to play them twice, make it as far apart, because there are a bunch of these, like the Pacers play the Hornets twice in the final week of the season. That is functionally very, very different than playing
Hornets
them almost any other time of the year, and all sorts of these things
during that period.
I know, exactly. So they get a huge competitive advantage, and there are a series of these. The Cavs and Nuggets played twice this week. They only play twice all year. So just make it a goal to spread those games out. Yeah, it might lead to more travel at certain points, but the competitive balance is exceedingly important, and it leads to these advantages and disadvantages.
I'm not quite as concerned about that as you, but I agree it's something that maybe they should consider more. But those poor schedule makers, I mean, those are the people who just, like, everyone complains about them, right? Like, no one has ever like, oh, he did a great job with the schedule. It's like they got a lot of shit that they have to balance. And adding one more thing in, you know, it would remain to be seen how much that would impact travel. You get the feeling that the NBA likes to avoid teams having to go on big long road trips in the last, you know, 2 weeks or so of the season. In Cleveland, the Cavs, who are going to owe at least $50.4 million in luxury taxes this season, what they are doing is dropping to 13 players for up to 2 weeks at a time, then waiting exactly 2 weeks to sign someone to a 10-day. They did that with Marcus Thornton. Now that that's over, they have another 2. The last team that really did that was, I think, the 13-14 Bulls. Once they got Andrew Bynum, were able to waive him and actually were able to duck below the tax that year, by just like keeping guys on the roster for the shortest possible amount of time.
Was that the Eric Murphy getting claimed by the Jazz one?
Yes. Although I think they would have eluded the tax anyway. But yeah, that was a big for Murphy. Actually, at least played some summer league for them. And then also with the Cavs, Kevin Love, after he had a nice piece in the Players Tribune talking about his anxiety, a panic attack that he had in Atlanta, subsequent reporting from Joe Varden indicated that he left the arena in what was initially termed an illness against OKC, that game where they got blown out so badly, that was also perhaps due to a panic attack, and certainly something that's difficult to manage. You know, it's good to know that he's been seeing therapists that he was set up with by the team, but that's something that really, you know, and there have been some great pieces on it. DeMar DeRozan had a piece in the Toronto Star after some tweets about, or he didn't write it, but had an interview in the Toronto Star about some tweets talking about his depression. Kelly Oubre recently as well. And so I applaud all these players for being willing to admit their issues, help others who are in the same place. And my hope is that there won't be, you know, any blowback on them in terms of their careers or like, oh, we can't trust this guy, he's having panic attacks type of stuff. But it seems like the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive so far.
It's great that they're doing this because athletes are so visible outside of the sports world, and they can in fact make people more comfortable with their own situations and raise awareness and everything like that. But also, I think this could have some real significance inside the NBA itself. Support for mental health and mental services is important, and it has been a part of it. I mean, I go back to the Royce White issues back in the day, where that was back in the day. It wasn't that long ago. And there is a huge incentive now for teams to make sure that they're protecting and valuing and everything the players that they have. But the more we talk about this, the more that it is out there, maybe they'll devote more resources and we can have more open conversations and lead to better outcomes for everybody.
I will finish up here with some more injury news. Darren Collison, whom we discussed before, well beyond that initial 2 to 3 week timetable, listening to the Pacers broadcast yesterday against the Jazz, does not sound like he is particularly close. They're speaking in terms of, well, you know, once you turn the corner, it can happen quickly, but that means clearly, you know, he's not practicing. It doesn't sound like he's doing, you know, full speed type of drills, that he's still experiencing some significant soreness there. So I'm not sure when we're going to see him. Jordan Bell, who had an awesome run after coming back from that weird eversion ankle sprain that he suffered against the Bulls coming down from a shot block, then sprained his right ankle, a more traditional inversion sprain coming down from a shot block against the Nets on Tuesday. But he says this one is not as significant, and, you know, hopefully he'll be back within a week or two. That kind of sounds like the timetable there. What else we got here?
Evan Fournier sprained his left knee and had to leave the game against the Lakers. That will presumably keep him out for a little while. Orlando, their incentives are very clear, but it's still, you know, it's still important. Yeah.
And they'd
to
actually been playing better healthy lately. But they really need him because it's a Flau and Wundu who are going to play more when he's out. I mean, when I say need, is assuming they're actually trying to win games. So they may take a step back now if he's going to miss time.
It will be fun to see a couple more games with Jonathan Simmons having the ball more. He has had that overall this year compared to one of the Spurs, but they'll have to rely on him, especially now with Elfrid Payton being in Phoenix. This, I think, he could get a lot of opportunities, and I want to see that. So I'm a little bit, you know, it's a silver lining to be sure, but doing that. Willie Cauley-Stein has missed 3 straight games with a back issue. He's still not practicing. The Kings have a ton of centers, but Cauley-Stein is certainly high on the list of the ones that are most relevant for their future.
Mo Harkless has missed 3 straight with a knee strain, but the Blazers continue rolling right along after a victory against the Knicks at home earlier this week. No understanding of exactly when Harkless is going to be back, but sounds like a relatively minor injury. And then the Raps have some injuries among their young guys. OG Anunoby did not play against Detroit in that classic game, which is going to be potentially right up there for our games of the month next month in our awards. But no timetable really for him on the ankle, but he didn't travel with the team, so it doesn't seem like he could miss some time. And then Dalen Wright aggravated a toe injury in that Detroit game. They took him out. Looks like he's going to be shut down for a little bit. So those guys are pretty key to that energy and effort, but hopefully they can get them right by the playoffs. And the Raps are blessed with enough depth that I don't expect this to significantly affect them over the next couple of weeks or so. And they also essentially have a 5-game lead in the projections, at least right now, on Boston.
Last piece of news, Joe Johnson missed the Wednesday game that the Rockets won against the Bucks in Milwaukee due to an illness. Ryan Anderson is is doubtful for Friday, and Brandon Wright's still going to be out a little while longer.
All right, that'll do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Try to give you guys a nice long one to take us into the weekend. We'll be back with the 15 and 60 on Sunday night to the Eastern Conference. Lots of interesting topics to hit on then. Talk to you all next week. Thanks again to Sonos for sponsoring today's program. I've been loving my Sonos, especially the fact that I was able to get them set up for free, and you can too if you live in any major metropolitan area. Just order from Sonos.com and select up and running at checkout, and you have much more reliable, much more controllable, much better quality sound than if you're just going with the old Bluetooth speaker in whatever room you want to listen to a podcast or music in from your phone. You can get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com when you use that promo code CAPSPACE10. A little bit different than the usual CAPSPACE10, CAPSPACE10 at Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. That's CAPSPACE10 at Sonos.com. Let them know that you came from us.